The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues for the next half hour. I'll be reading articles principally from the Harvard Heart Letter. This is the August 2024 issue. And the first article is very relevant. It is asking the question, can you reduce your cholesterol without taking a drug? Dietary changes can help, and certain supplements might be worth trying, but choose carefully. It's one of the most common questions people ask their doctor. How do I lower my cholesterol? Many of them hope to avoid taking drugs, while others are interested in natural cholesterol-lowering medications, like the Heart Letter reader who wrote us recently. She's an active, slender 76-year-old who follows a heart-friendly diet, mostly organic fruits and vegetables, grains, and lean meats, but no red meat and no alcohol. Her blood pressure and blood sugar levels are normal, but her LDL or bad cholesterol is 157 milligrams per deciliter, which is considered borderline high. In general, there are three main ways to lower LDL to the recommended 100 or lower: diet, a dietary supplement, or a prescription medication like a statin. Here's how Heart Letter Editor-in-Chief Dr. Christopher Cannon counsels patients on this topic. What many people don't realize is that only about 20% of the cholesterol in your bloodstream comes from your diet. Your liver and intestines make the rest. For most people, the cholesterol present in food doesn't have that much of an effect. Most of the cholesterol in the average person's diet comes from animal-based foods, like meat and dairy, which are also high in saturated fat. Saturated fat clearly raises LDL cholesterol and should be consumed in limited amounts. The rest of your diet matters too. Swap saturated fat for unsaturated fat, such as those found in vegetable oils, avocados, and fatty fish. Eat plenty of plant foods like vegetables, fruits, beans, and whole grains, especially oats, that are rich in fiber, which helps to lower your cholesterol by making dietary cholesterol harder to absorb from your gut. If you eat cheeseburgers and ice cream regularly, but then gradually transition to a healthier diet, you're likely to see your LDL level fall. If your diet is already quite healthy, like the reader described above, further tweaks might not make that much of a difference. I often tell people that while some people see a modest reduction in their LDL after changing their diet, some do not, says Dr. Cannon. Still, a healthy diet has other cardiovascular benefits, even if your LDL doesn't drop very much, he adds. For example, many of the compounds found in whole, unprocessed plant foods help dampen inflammation, discouraging plaque buildup. Many dietary supplements sold in the United States claim to benefit heart health, but only three may help drive down LDL cholesterol, and only by a modest amount. The first is psyllium husk. Derived from the seeds of the Plantago ovata plant, this fiber supplement is best known as a treatment for constipation. Metamucil is one familiar brand. The powder is mixed with liquid to make a thick gel. Psyllium husk or powder is also available in wafers, bars, and capsules. It's thought to absorb bile acids and cholesterol, which are then eliminated from the body during bowel movements. The suggested daily dose is 5 to 10 grams. An April 2024 review article in the journal Nutrients found that taking psyllium daily for a month can lower LDL by about 6 points on average. Then there are plant sterols. found naturally in the cell membranes of plants like nuts, soybeans, peas, and rapeseed. These compounds, also called phytosterols, have a structure similar to cholesterol. Eating them helps to limit the amount of cholesterol your body absorbs. Manufacturers offer many types of foods with added plant sterols, including margarine, like Benecol, mayonnaise, bread, breakfast and snack bars, milk, and juice. Phytosterols are also available in capsule form. Some studies show that consuming 2 grams of plant sterols per day can lower LDL up to 10%. But a recent carefully controlled 4-week trial, the supplements, placebo, or rosuvastatin trial, or SPORT, found only a 4.4% LDL reduction from plant sterols. Finally, there's red yeast rice. Made by steaming white rice with the yeast Monascus purpureus, this red-hued extract contains monacolin K, the same active ingredient in the prescription cholesterol-lowering drug lovastatin. Some studies suggest that supplements containing 4 milligrams to 10 milligrams of monacolin K can lower the LDL between 20 and 25%. But the SPORT study reported only a 6.6% LDL reduction from red yeast rice. I have several patients who've been able to lower the LDL a little bit with psyllium, which is safe and inexpensive. The problem with the plant sterols in red yeast rice is the same with all dietary supplements. The amount of active ingredient is not regulated and may vary from batch to batch. If you want to try these products, do so only under a doctor's supervision and use brands tested and vetted by ConsumerLab.com, an independent testing company. Unlike dietary supplements, drugs in the class known as statins contain a known amount of the active ingredient, a compound that both decreases the amount of cholesterol the body makes and boosts the liver's ability to clear cholesterol from the blood. These drugs can lower LDL between 25 and 55%. Note that simply having an elevated LDL cholesterol doesn't mean that you should be taking a statin. The ultimate goal is to lower your risk of heart disease and other factors. He recommends using the American College of Cardiology's risk calculator, available at www.health.harvard.edu. /ASCVD. The calculator provides treatment advice about managing your LDL and other heart risk factors, which you can then discuss with your physician. For our reader, a moderate intensity statin may be reasonable, according to the calculator's recommendation. When people are reluctant to start taking a statin, a coronary calcium score can help them make a more informed decision. Our reader's calcium score is 116, which suggests she has a small amount of plaque in her coronary arteries. But any number above zero means a person has coronary artery disease, Dr. Cannon explains. Anyone with that diagnosis should get their LDL down to 70 or lower, which will help prevent additional plaque buildup. For someone with an LDL of 157, a statin is the most effective means to reach that goal. Now we're going to turn to a question and answer section, which is written by Dr. Christopher Cannon, who's the editor-in-chief of the Harvard Heart Letter. Question: my mother has atrial fibrillation and takes a blood thinner to prevent stroke. But are there other risks she should know about? Atrial fibrillation, known as AFib, is a common disorder marked by rapid, irregular heart rhythm that causes the blood to pool in the heart's upper chamber or atria. The stagnant blood can form clots, which may then travel to the brain and cause stroke. That's why people with AFib take blood thinners, which don't actually thin the blood, but rather discourage clot formation. While doctors have long warned about the heightened risk of stroke with AFib, a recent study found that heart failure, when the heart fails to pump adequate amounts of blood to the body, might be a risk that occurs even more often. For that study, researchers evaluated the health information of 3.5 million people aged 45 to 95 for a 23-year period. Among those who developed AFib, heart failure was by far the most common complication. The lifetime risk of a heart failure was 2 out of every 5 people, more than twice as likely as the risk of stroke, which occurred in about 1 in 5 people. The connection between AFib and heart failure isn't entirely clear, but researchers suspect that the erratic and ineffective beating of the atria forces the lower chambers to work harder. Over time, that may take a toll on the heart's pumping ability. It's yet another reason people with AFib should take steps to prevent the progression of their condition. But your mother should also be vigilant about the early warning signs of heart failure, which can be subtle and easy to miss. People often attribute feeling tired or a little winded to being out of shape or growing older, but these symptoms may signal a decline in the heart's pumping ability. The classic warning signs for heart failure include fatigue. A weakened heart can't deliver enough oxygen-rich blood to meet the body's needs. Activity limitation. Because people with heart failure tire easily, they often struggle to do everyday activities, like making a meal or taking a short walk. Congestion. The heart's poor pumping ability causes blood to back up and fluid to leak into the lungs, which can trigger coughing and wheezing. Edema, or ankle swelling. Excess fluid can also collect in the ankles, legs, and thighs, as well as the abdomen, which may cause rapid weight gain. Finally, there's shortness of breath. Lung congestion makes breathing difficult, a problem that's often worse when the person lies down, because excess fluid from the lower body moves up toward the lungs. Now here's another interesting article from the Harvard Heart Letter of August 2024, and it's entitled, Are Heart Attacks Overdiagnosed? Fear of a malpractice lawsuit is just one reason doctors may diagnose heart attacks in people who haven't had one. More than 2 decades ago, a now classic study revealed an unsettling statistic. About 2% of people who showed up in the emergency departments in the throes of a heart attack were mistakenly sent home without treatment. Failure to diagnose a heart attack is the number one cause of malpractice payouts in the emergency department, says Dr. James Januzzi, the Hutter Family Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School and a cardiologist at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. What's happened since then has created a different problem. Out of fear of missing the diagnosis, doctors may screen people with symptoms that are subtle, unusual, or even completely absent. Because the blood test used to detect a heart attack is so sensitive, some people are told they're having a possible heart attack, also known as a myocardial infarction, or MI, when they are not. In fact, overdiagnosis of MI is now more common than underdiagnosis, says Dr. Januzzi, who co-authored an opinion piece on this topic in the April 24, 2024 issue of JAMA. Failing to detect an actual heart attack can have dire consequences. But overdiagnosis exposes people to unneeded risks, high costs, and other downsides. What usually happens when people arrive in the emergency department with a possible heart attack? How can you make sure that you or a loved one receives appropriate care? Most emergency departments follow a specific protocol for a suspected heart attack. The first test is an electrocardiogram, a recording of the heart's electrical activity. A major heart attack, when an artery feeding your heart is blocked, choking off the blood supply to part of the muscle, usually creates a distinct signature in the EKG. But the EKG is not very sensitive, and a normal tracing doesn't rule out a heart attack. So doctors rely on a high-sensitivity troponin test, which measures a protein that rises in response to heart muscle damage. The troponin test, that's T-R-O-P-O-N-I-N, has evolved over the years to now being so sensitive it's rare to miss cases of MI. Because this test is so sensitive, though, we're detecting a lot of myocardial injury that's not related to a heart attack, says Dr. Januzzi. One possible cause is heart muscle inflammation, or myocarditis, which can result from bacterial or viral infection, including COVID-19. Certain types of heart failure and chronic kidney disease can also cause the troponin level to rise. A single abnormal troponin level, or a value that rises slightly over time, doesn't necessarily mean you've had a heart attack. One study found that 1/4 of people who showed up in an emergency department received a troponin test, although fewer than half complained of chest pain. Why does this happen? One reason is, like most people, physicians tend to remember rare, unusual scenarios more than typical everyday situations, says Dr. Januzzi. While 99 of 100 people who have heart attacks come in with classic symptoms, most doctors have seen at least one person who had a bizarre symptom like elbow pain that turned out to be a heart attack. That drives a lot of excess testing, he says. Heart attacks are more common in older people, but such people are also more prone to chronic health problems that might lead to an abnormal troponin result. Consequently, they're more likely to have elevated troponin values that don't necessarily represent a heart attack. People incorrectly diagnosed with a heart attack often undergo further testing, including costly imaging tests, potentially risky invasive procedures, and unnecessary hospitalizations. About 1 in 5 people diagnosed with a heart attack experiences depression, and a third face financial hardship due to medication costs. The diagnosis may also affect a person's ability to get or afford life insurance. If a doctor tells you that some of your test results suggest a possible heart attack, be mindful that the diagnosis requires much more than a single blood test. Ask what other evidence points to a heart attack, like changes on an EKG or heart ultrasound. An accurate diagnosis is vital, as treatments for each situation differ considerably, he adds. And the article goes on to point out that typical heart attack symptoms are discomfort, pressure, or squeezing, usually in the center of your chest, pain in one or both arms or shoulders or in your back, neck, or jaw, a rapid or irregular heartbeat, trouble breathing, feeling lightheaded or dizzy, and feeling sick to your stomach, possibly vomiting. Now, here's an interesting article entitled Rethinking HDL Cholesterol. Cholesterol, a waxy, pale yellow fat, travels through the bloodstream in tiny protein-covered particles called lipoproteins that mix easily with blood. You need cholesterol to create cell membranes, make hormones, and synthesize vitamin D, among other things. But if you're trying to avoid heart disease, you should keep tabs on your blood cholesterol values, especially your low-density lipoprotein, or LDL, or bad cholesterol. Too much LDL in the bloodstream helps to create artery-clogging plaque, raising your risk of a heart attack. Your cholesterol report also includes your HDL, or high-density lipoprotein. HDL has long been referred to as good cholesterol based on observational studies dating back decades, showing that people with high HDL levels are less likely to develop cardiovascular disease. A low HDL cholesterol is generally less than 40 milligrams per deciliter. High is defined as 60 milligrams per deciliter and above. However, the scientific understanding of HDL has evolved in ensuing years, and many cardiologists now believe that HDL may be more of a bystander rather than a good guy that helps lower heart disease risk. Higher HDL levels are closely linked with behaviors like eating a healthy diet and getting regular exercise, says Dr. Stephen Wiviat, a cardiologist at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. Researchers have also discovered that the way HDL functions and its role in the body are more complex than once believed. The analogy that's often used is to describe HDL as a garbage truck because it picks up extra cholesterol from the bloodstream and the arteries, then transports it to the liver where it's recycled or disposed, says Dr. Wiviat. That was the rationale behind the creation of experimental drugs that raised HDL levels dramatically, between 60 and 100%. Over the past decade, a large clinical trial tested five of these drugs that are called SEPT inhibitors in people with low HDL levels. But while the drugs reliably raised HDL, they didn't achieve the most important goal, preventing heart attack, stroke, and other complications from clogged arteries. Maybe the thinking went, it wasn't the number of garbage trucks that mattered, but how good they were at picking up trash. That is, maybe the drugs increased the wrong kind of HDL cholesterol. It turns out that HDL comes in different shapes and sizes. Some types are spherical, while others are donut shapes. Some types of HDL are great at plucking excess cholesterol from LDL and artery walls, while some are not. What if you had an HDL-based drug specifically designed to improve reverse cholesterol transport? Think of it as an empty garbage truck with a better trash compactor. But when investigators tested four weekly infusions of this type of experimental drug on more than 18,000 recent heart attack survivors, it was no better than a placebo in preventing heart attack, stroke, or death. As detailed in a study published May 2, 2024, in the New England Journal of Medicine. It's yet another point of reference to suggest that targeting HDL with medications may not be helpful, Dr. Wiviat says. But these findings shouldn't distract you from focusing on the factors you can control, namely making sure your LDL is below 100 milligrams per deciliter, or even lower if you have heart disease. That's true even if you have a high HDL level, which shouldn't be considered overly reassuring or a reason to ignore an elevated LDL level. The article goes on to point out that the desirable total cholesterol is less than 200 milligrams per deciliter, while a high cholesterol is 240 milligrams per deciliter and above. The optimal LDL cholesterol is less than 100. A high LDL cholesterol is 160 to 189. And a very high LDL cholesterol is 190 and above. Then it points out that triglycerides are considered durable when they're less than 150 milligrams per deciliter, and high when they're 200 to 499 milligrams per deciliter. A very brief article, all types of alcohol appear to raise blood pressure. The more alcohol people drink, the higher their blood pressure, according to a large Danish study. More than 104,000 adults underwent a physical exam and answered questions about their drinking habits. 3/4 reported drinking more than one type of alcohol. 13% said they drank only red wine. 5% drank only beer. 2% drank only white wine. And 1% drank only spirits. Most had 3 to 14 drinks per week. Fewer than 3% drank more than 35 drinks per week. But the average blood pressure readings among those heavy drinkers were strikingly higher than those of people who had just one or two drinks per week. For both men and women, there was a strong, graded association between alcohol intake and blood pressure, no matter what type of alcohol they drank. Those findings were published online in the May 13, 2024 issue of the American Journal of Medicine. And the heavy drinkers, those who drank 35 or more drinks per week, had blood pressure readings of 11 points higher in the systolic reading and 7 points higher in the diastolic reading than those who were only drinking one or two drinks per week. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.